Father, as we consider how to use wisely the time you've given us, just pray that we'd hear you speak today. We pray that everything we do and say would be honoring to you. In Jesus' name, amen. Turn your Bibles to Exodus 18, and we will read starting in verse 13. You will notice on the handout it is broken into two segments. One is the advice Moses received from his father-in-law Jethro, and that's numbers 1 through 8, and then numbers 9 through 14 are what I've labeled as beyond Jethro. And I'm sure we can find verses for these, but I have not proof-texted them, so we'll just take those in two segments. Exodus 18, 13 through 26. The picture here is that the children of Israel have left Egypt, and Moses is more or less running the show. And I don't know, you know, where you are in your life and in your career and everything you do in life, but if you're very busy at all, there are times you've felt like Moses in this passage. So here we go. The next day, Moses took his seat to serve as judge for the people, and they stood around him from morning until evening. Now, I can remember one time about 20 years ago when we were really growing in our business, and I totaled it up one day, and in an eight-hour day, I'd had about 100 phone calls or personal visits with people. So, you know, it's about like Moses. There was just never an end to it. The people stood around from morning till evening. When his father-in-law saw all that Moses was doing for the people, he said, "What is this you're doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge while all these people stand around you again from morning till evening?" Makes a long day of it. Moses answered him, "Because the people come to me to seek God's will. Whenever they have a dispute, it is brought to me, and I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and laws." Does this sound insane yet to you? Moses' father-in-law replied, "What you're doing is not good. You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out," emphasis added. "The work is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone. Listen now to me, and I will give you some advice, and may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to Him. Teach them the decrees and laws and show them the way to live and the duties they are to perform. But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands and hundreds and fifties and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times, but have them bring every difficult case to you, the simple cases they can decide themselves. That will make your load lighter because they will share it with you. If you do this, and God so commands, you will be able to stand the strain and all these people will go home satisfied." Moses listened to his father-in-law and did everything he said. He chose capable men from all Israel and made them leaders of the people, officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. They served as judges for the people at all times. The difficult cases they brought to Moses, but the simple ones they decided themselves. Well, what I want to talk about is just some principles for how to manage our time. And the first one is that you have enough time to accomplish God's purpose for you. In other words, if you ever make the statement, "I just don't have enough time," I really believe that's unbiblical. Because God made the time, right? And He made 24 hours in a day, and He made 7 days in a week, and 365 days in a year. And He knows that you need rest, and He knows that you need time with your family. And so He made the time. He set up the boundaries within which we live. And then we get our purpose from God. Whether it's work, or whether it's family, or whether it's ministry, or whether it's recreation, or whatever we're doing, ought to be under God's direction. We ought to be doing it because we feel called to it by God. And so if I say God has given me more work to do than I have time to do, then I'm putting God in a position of contradiction, aren't I? Now, what may be true, I may be in the position Moses was in. Maybe the work is coming my way, and maybe God did put me in a leadership position over the people, or whatever position I'm in. God, let's assume God did put me there, and let's assume God put you where you are. But to say, "I just don't have the time," I think is a contradiction, because it basically you're saying God didn't know what he was doing when he set up 24 hours in a day and gave you the job that you have to do, all the duties that you have. And if you had to, you know, you hear people say, well, I just wish there were more hours in the day. No, you don't. That's like just saying, that's like if you're deep in debt saying, I just wish I had more money. You'd still wind up deep in debt. The reason you're deep in debt is because you don't wisely handle the money that you have. And the reason that you don't have enough time is that you're not wisely handling the time that God has given you. So the first thing we need to acknowledge is that we have enough time to accomplish God's purpose for us. I have enough time to accomplish God's purpose for me. Number two is to live by established priorities. Don't allow others to impose their agenda on me. Don't allow others to impose their agenda on you. In my office, and for those of you who don't know, I'm mayor of Oklahoma City. It's largely a volunteer job. I was out with some firefighters the other day. I ride with them 1 month and the police the next month for about a half a day. And so I pulled out, I happened to feel in my pocket, and I had this month's paycheck. And I wanted to make them feel good. And so I pulled out this month's paycheck and kind of passed it around the table. The net was $2.01. I'm not joking, that's the truth. It's largely a volunteer job. But Oklahoma City is a city of 500,000 people. It's a metro area of about 1.1 million. It's a budget of about $600 million a year. So if you don't have a handout, raise your hand. Okay, we've got quite a few back there. And so it could easily be that there would be far more than I could accomplish. In fact, the way we work is every Monday I sit down with my secretary. I have a staff, by the way, enormous staff of 2 people. Now, we do have a city manager, and he has a staff of 4,500 people. But in the mayor's office, I have a secretary and an assistant. And so every Monday we sit down, and my secretary goes over all the requests that came in this week, you know, for speaking or whatever. And generally it's a stack about that high of letters. And so we go through them, and in about 45 minutes, we'll go through all those requests, and we'll either say yes or no or maybe. And a lot of times, I'll say, well, who's asking? Because, you know, if my friend Derry Myers asks me to come speak somewhere, then I'll do it. But if it's someone I don't know, and if that issue's not important to me, then I probably won't. Well, the point is, live by established priorities. Don't allow others to impose their agenda on you. If we don't set out what our purpose is and set out what our agenda is, then we will get our lives filled up with other people's agenda. And that's not true just in the mayor's office. That's true in your life, isn't it? In fact, you know, Mary had a little lamb. It would have been a sheep, but it joined a Southern Baptist church and died for lack of sleep. You know, not all these agendas are bad. In fact, many of them are good. There are things like your church. There are things like your kids' school. There are things like, gee whiz, if you're going to figure out what your priorities are in life, do not count soccer as family time. You know, the kids are out there and you're here, but that is not quality time, folks. But it's things like that. I mean, we've just never gotten into that, but I'll guarantee you in this room there are people sitting here who have 4 soccer games a week or 6. Am I right? You know, because you got 2 kids and they do, you know. And so if you don't establish what your priorities are, then others have their desires for you and they will totally control your life. A number of months ago, I heard Norman Schwarzkopf speak, and the general who led in the Gulf War. And he said when he was a captain in Vietnam that nobody could tell you why we were there. And nobody could say what the priorities of the big general were. But no one knew what the big man's priorities were. And so in Vietnam, we just got stuck in the swamp, right? We just kind of flailed around there for about 10 or 12 years. We went to the Gulf War, and President Bush said, these are our five priorities. Now, we may disagree about those priorities. We may wish that one of them was, you know, we're going to bury Saddam Hussein 6 feet under the soil. That was not one of them. So you may disagree with what they were, but the whole world knew what his five priorities were. Where we want to get the Iraqis out of Kuwait. You know, he had five priorities, listed them out. And so when Schwarzkopf and the fellows went over there to do the job, they knew what the big man's priorities were. And everything was geared toward those five priorities. We should have priorities established in our lives. You should for your family. You should for your business. Maybe you're running the show. Then your whole company should know what your top three or four or five priorities are for your company. In my job in Oklahoma City, a big part of my job is to throw out the vision. I'm the communicator for the city. And so I'll tell you, a lot of folks around town know that my three priorities are Oklahoma City schools, the community appearance, and improve air service in Oklahoma City. Those are my three highest priorities in Oklahoma City. There are a lot of other things we do, but those are always at the top of the list. So we need to establish what our priorities are. Our family is getting ready to move. We lived in the same house for 20 years. We love the house. We love the neighborhood. I think it's the prettiest street in Oklahoma City. But I have a seventh grade daughter, and all of her friends go to school in Edmond, which is just north of Oklahoma City. And so we're moving up where she can go to Edmond schools, and I'll still be living in Oklahoma City. It's kind of a strange way our boundaries work. But we're moving so my daughter can go to school with kids that are her friends at church. And what that's saying is that my daughter being with her friends is more important than me being close to my work. It's a higher priority. Now, it's only going to be for 5 years. I mean, 5 years she'll be gone, and then I can go live anywhere I want. So we're making a five-year decision to put her where in a situation that would be best for her, because that's a higher priority than my convenience. So establish what your priorities are, and then live by those, because if you don't, others will impose their priorities on your life. Third is delegate. You can't do it all by yourself. You know, Moses' father came in, and he looked at him, and he said, what you're doing is not good. Because Moses was doing exactly what most of us would naturally tend to do. Now, the hard thing about this talk today is that I'm speaking, some people in the room know me, and that makes it difficult. But I'll tell you this, my tendency when I first started in business was to do everything myself. Darry, am I telling the truth? In fact, I had people so mortified in our company. They could not move a desk 6 inches. I'm not joking. They could not move a desk 6 inches without my approval. They couldn't do anything without my approval. It was a terrible way to run a company. But that's where I came from. In fact, I clearly remember back when we started in business in 1972, I clearly remember the last time that I worked directly in a store. We started out and we just had four employees. Well, we had 30 and we shrunk down to four. But that's another story. But we started growing the company, and so we had a philosophy that what you had to do is get the store counter. We sold to retail stores, and we had to get the store counter set up right. And really, the best people to do that were my brother Kent or me. And so we set every counter. I mean, we set every counter. And then in 1979, about the time we hired Darry, I was in Amarillo setting a counter in a store. We got a call, and we bought a company in Kansas City, and so I flew in, went to Kansas City, and that's the last time I set a store counter. After that, I hired it done. But where I came from was a mindset, and this is an erroneous mindset, but I'll tell you what my mindset was, because some of you will have the same mindset. My mindset was, I'm smarter than they are, I work harder than they are, I can do it better than they'll do it, therefore I'm going to do it. That was my mindset. Now, that was Moses' mindset too, right? He was doing it all himself. And can you get the picture of what was going on there? Moses is sitting there, he starts early in the morning, and the people line up. Because if they have a problem, they bring it to Moses, right? They line up. And it says that they're all, they are there standing around all day until the evening. Every day. Is that what it says? I'm like Moses, you know. We were both not, you know, it was not good what he was doing. It was not good what I was doing. And so delegating did not come naturally to me. And I don't know about you. Now, to some people, it comes naturally. My brother Kent is here. I don't know if he's talking somewhere or learning something else. I don't think he's in the room here. Kent is a far better natural delegator than I am. Derry, am I telling the truth? Far better. Kent is a generalist. Kent will say, build a building. That's the last thought he has about it. You know, I worry about traffic flows and where the walls go and how things work. And so now, I'm over a city with a $600 million budget. And you wouldn't believe what a generalist I am now. But you got to delegate. You cannot do it all by yourself. And here's how I came to that realization. If you try to do it all by yourself, you're going to be exactly like Moses, and you're going to get worn out. And when you're worn out, that doesn't work very good in life, and you're not going to do a very good job, and you're going to be irritable. That never happened to me, did it, Derry? And there's another error in my philosophy. You know what? I'm not smarter than all those folks. In fact, there are some tasks that other people can do a whole lot better than me. And there are some gifts that folks have that I don't have. And so what I need to do is I need to... Jethro said, you find faithful men, God-fearing men. What I need to do is find people who are better in that area than I would be. You know, in some areas, they're not going to be as good as I am. But you know what? If they're 80% as good as I am and I can hire 10 of them, then that's 800% instead of 100%. Even if they're not as good, even if they're not as quick as you are, you can get a whole bunch of them working for you. But many times you're going to find, if you're talking about artistic things or computer things or sales or whatever it is, they're going to be far better if you'll just turn them loose to do their job. So we need to delegate, and we need to empower our people. We need to turn them loose. When I became mayor of Oklahoma City, how many live in Oklahoma? How many live in Oklahoma City? Oklahoma City area. Okay. Okay. When I became mayor of Oklahoma City 2 years ago, we had the largest, as far as number of projects and scope for the size of our town, the largest set of urban projects that any city has ever tackled at one time. We called them the MAPS projects. It was about $360 million, but it was 9 major facilities, mostly in downtown Oklahoma City, all going on at one time. No other city has ever tackled that. And it was very controversial when I became mayor, because the prevailing philosophy was, you guys can't bring a job in on time, you can't bring a job in on budget. And so I don't know how to do that, but there are other folks that do. And so my first Monday in office, I have on my schedule a visit from 2 of the architects who are overseeing the MAPS projects. And I said, okay, what's this about? They said, well, we meet every Monday with the mayor. Now, you got to get the picture. As mayor, basically, I'm like chairman of the board. It's like city council's the board, and I'm chairman of the board, and the city manager is really the chief executive officer of the city. And 4,500 people work under the city manager. He reports to us. That's kind of the parallel in business. What does it do if the architects from outside come and meet with the mayor every Monday? What does that do to the city manager and the fellow under him who's over the MAPS projects and is supposed to work with the contractors and all the people to make these things happen? What does that do to them? It undermines their authority. It totally jerks power out from under them, because you know what the architects are going to do the rest of the week? They're going to go, well, we were with the mayor Monday, and I think we ought to do this. And so I've empowered the outsiders, and I've totally disempowered my people, right? And so these guys come in, they say, well, we meet with the mayor every Monday. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll call you if I need you. And I have not met with them since, in 2 years. And every job that we have done, and we've done 5 or 6 of them since then, every job that we've done, has come in under, at or below budget and on time. Because I just by doing that, and I didn't understand everything that I was doing when I said, I don't need to see you every week. But that totally freed up the city's people to do their job. And we have good people. You know, I'll tell you what, you may think of folks that work for the government as a bunch of slackers. And I'm sure in some segments that might be true. But I'll tell you one place that's not true is in the management of our city. We have outstanding people. But I'll tell you, that sent shockwaves through the troops when they saw that I was going to trust them to do it and I was not going to be sticking my nose in it all the time. Derry, can you believe that? It's a conversion. But listen, if you're going to get anything done, you have to delegate. Got a question for you. Tell me, who, in your opinion, are the most effective presidents of the United States of the 20th century? Give me some names. Reagan. Someone else. Give me more than one. Eisenhower. Reagan, Eisenhower, Teddy Roosevelt. Now let me define who, in your opinion, had a greater impact in changing the direction, influencing the direction of life in our nation and the world. And let's call that an effective president, okay? Reagan, Franklin Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, Eisenhower. Are there any others? Johnson for the negative. Oh, I shouldn't say that. Landslide Lyndon. We'll talk about that later. But, okay. And I'm going to take a little liberty here, but let's just say that it's Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Reagan. And I think you could make a compelling case for all of those and some others too. Now let's concentrate on Reagan. And let's contrast him with a good man, but a name I did not hear here today, and a name I would not say was the most effective president, Jimmy Carter. The knock on Ronald Reagan is that he was a cowboy actor. He was a movie star. And all you had to do is script him, and he'd read the script, and he'd look pretty good. That was the knock on Ronald Reagan. The advertising for Jimmy Carter said, this man is a nuclear scientist. He's a nuclear engineer. And, you know, he is really bright. And a good man. How did Jimmy Carter handle the presidency? Do you know? He got lost in all the details. He wanted to get buried in details. He micromanaged it. And I'll tell you what, no one could tell you where Carter was trying to take us, because if he knew, he sure didn't communicate it. And what's the one word that comes to mind when you think of his presidency? Malaise. It's the word, he goes, we're in this great national malaise. Gee, doesn't that inspire confidence? Reagan understood leadership. Reagan understood that his role, and by the way, I mean, when Carter walked out of the office, he walked in, so the situation was the same. When Reagan walked into the office, we had however many hostages in Iran. Now, they didn't last the afternoon as hostages. We had double-digit inflation. We had double-digit interest rates. We had problems with Russia. Was it 1980 that they were in Afghanistan? Is that right? Is that 80? It was not a good picture. But Reagan knew that the primary role as leader of the United States was to cast a vision, and he did that. And just with a smile on his face and his confidence, we started feeling better about ourselves. And the Russians started feeling worse about themselves. And then Reagan said, I'm going to spend enough money on defense that I'm going to put you guys out of business to the Russians. And he called them an evil empire. Yeah, and he talked about the Star Wars defense, which we don't know if it'll work, but they didn't know that. Do you know what Reagan did while he was president? I'm talking about delegating. What Reagan did while he was president, about three nights a week in the White House, he had movie time. And he watched a movie. And I don't know if he ate popcorn, but if it was my house, we would. He watched a movie about three nights a week. And about a third of the days of his presidency, he spent on his ranch in California, riding his horse and chopping wood. Now, we didn't know that. When I got in office, my predecessor, Ron Norick, had been in office for 11 years, and I have a lot of respect for Ron, and I went and talked with him when I was thinking about running, and he goes, one thing I tell you, he says, the first 2 years I was in office, I went solid 7 days a week. And so then, after that, I wouldn't let him book me on Sunday. Okay, I've been in office about 2 years. I don't let him book me on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. Friday, I try to keep for my business, and invariably it gets encroached upon. But I generally spend on my business anywhere from, this week it was about an hour and a half, because this is my business day to day, okay? Generally, now it's about 2 to 3 hours a week. Some weeks it's a whole day on Friday. But Saturday and Sunday are family time. It's very, very rare that I take a speaking engagement in another church on Sunday morning. I think I've taken about 2 in 2 years. Because if I start taking speaking engagements on Sunday morning, I'll never be in my own church. And then what kind of shape will I be in and my family? So Saturday and Sunday are church time and family time. And I've averaged about 5 to 6 weeks of vacation a week, a week. A year. About 5 to 6 weeks of vacation a year. Now, how do you do that? Well, you do it just by saying, you're not going to book me Friday or Saturday, Sunday, and at the first of the year, I'm doing these things on these weeks, and I'll be gone. I'll go you one better than that. I wanted to go to Colorado for 2 weeks of vacation, because if you just take a week of vacation, then about the end of the week, you're starting to wind down, and then you go right back into it. So if you take a two-week vacation, about the end of the first week, you're starting to wind down. The second week, you don't even care what day it is. I mean, you relax. So I wanted to go to Colorado for 2 weeks of vacation, and so I went to city council, and I said, we meet every Tuesday, and I said, I recommend that we take a summer break for the last week in July and the first week in August. Now, how did I pick those dates? That's when I wanted to be in Colorado. And they did it. So last year, we took off the last week in August, first week in July. This year, I came back in planning for the year summer 2000. One of the guys liked it so much last year, he said, you know what, once we get the budget done at the end of June, why don't we just take off every other week for July and August? And so that's what we're doing this year. We won't even have city council meeting. You know, the truth is, the best thing that you could do with the legislature is have them take every year off. Now, in Texas, they come close. They take every other year off in Texas. Yeah. But anyway, so this summer, city council will not meet every other week for the months of July and August. And so, guess what? We can take vacations. We can, and guess what? Our staff can, too. And when we're there, we'll be much more full force, and we won't be all diverted during the summertime because we planned. Delegate. You can't do it all by yourself. Leverage your efforts. Many hands make light work. Have you ever been in a fundraising campaign in church for like a building program? Now, I don't know how yours did it, but I'll tell you, everyone I've been in, they've done it this way. They get, you know, the general chairman, then they have several sub-chairmen under him, and then they have captains, and then they have lieutenants, and they will make their goal, because anyone who's worth a flip has a job in the campaign. Okay? The dog who walks through the parking lot probably has a job in the campaign. And if you're going to be in the campaign, you have to give money. And so they will be about 80% of the way to their goal when the folks on the inside have given. And then the other 20% you just get here and there from around. They get a lot of people involved. And that's what Moses' father-in-law advised him to do. to do. He said, what you do is you set them up in areas and you have this guy over just 10 people. And then the next one's over 50. So he has five of those captains. Captains of 10, he has five. The next guy's over hundreds. And then you have a guy over thousands. I mean, this is a military town, Wichita Falls. How does the military organize? You know, you have a platoon and what's that, six or eight? Is that right? My exposure to the military is ROTC in college. And I didn't like it very well. Anyway, but you have a platoon and then a company and so on. And generally, the higher you move up, the fewer people you supervise directly. So that's the way the military organizes it. That's the way business organizes it. That's the way fundraising drives organize it. And that's the way Jethro advised Moses to organize it. And you find people that are appropriate for that. And you may say, well, that guy's not the sharpest guy in the world. Well, can he oversee 10 people? And, you know, some people will surprise you what they can do, too. They may not look the sharpest, but maybe they're just a bulldog for tenacity, and maybe they get the job done. So you leverage your efforts. And this is what I'm talking about, you know how a lever works? If you want to move a rock, you can't move the rock, but if you get a lever under it and a fulcrum, then you can just like that move a rock. Sharp as you are, they may not work as hard as you do. But if you can get a whole lot of people involved, you can do massive things. And you can greatly multiply your efforts. So leverage your efforts. Number five is build on your strengths and staff to your weaknesses. Moses' father-in-law gave him some qualification for the men that he'd put in leadership. And I'm not saying Moses didn't have those qualifications, but you know, when you get out in the world we live in, you're going to have some strengths. Maybe you're a great generalist. My son is getting started in the business world, and I told someone the other day he's one good secretary away from being a millionaire. Because, I mean, he has great energy, he's great with people, but he's not always the best with details. He called me up and he said, we got invited to go to a groundbreaking for a new building. Well, we turned it down. So then my son calls me. Turns out it was his company that was involved in it. And said, hey, boy, they really want you, and it'd really do make me look great if I could get you out there. I said, okay, well, if you'll come get me and drive me out there, then I can spend the time talking to you, and so I'll come. So it starts at 10:30 one morning, about 10 after 10. I'm downtown. That's way out on the edge of town. He's supposed to come get me. He's not there. And so I waited, and I told my secretary, I said, well, I'm going to take off. If he comes, tell him I'm on the way. I get out there. I mean, television stations are there. The media's there. His bosses are there. The clients are there. Everyone's there. I'm there. My son's not there. We have the groundbreaking. TV cameras roll, everything. Everyone's happy. That afternoon, he called me. Dad, I forgot. You need to build on your strengths and staff to your weaknesses. He needs a good secretary. He also needs a Palm Pilot, which he has now. By the way, I could not find Palm Pilots in Scripture. However, you know, there are some things God just trusts us to do, and I would advise you to get one of these. How many have something like this? I'm telling you. Now, you probably think I'm goofy. And I heard about this because Derry went on staff at Henderson Hills Baptist, and they all had Palm Pilots, and they would beam each other up with these things. You know, they, but since I was in college, I carried the official approved navigator diary. Little pages, and you have to write real small. And so when I became mayor, that's what I did. And my secretary did what she'd been doing for years, and she would type my schedule out. And so if we got a speaking request and it's 3 months from now, then she had to type it into the long-range calendar. And then when it came to that week, she had to type it on the daily calendar and the weekly calendar. And we were even talking about hiring more help to help her keep up with all this stuff. And I decided to buy, my wife went and bought a Palm Pilot for me. And I thought, oh, that's kind of spooky. You do this little graffiti stuff to write. I mean, you can write stuff into it. And people go, oh, that's too hard to learn. Yes, it is. It takes about 10 minutes to learn it. She estimates that this saves her about a day and a half a week on keeping up with our work. Because I go into the office and I put it on her desk and she throws it in the cradle and it synchronizes. If I've added something to it, it changes her records. It knows who did it latest. And if she's added something to it, it changes my records. And it synchronizes between her workstation and this. And then I pop out the door and I know where to go. And she writes all the directions in here. All the phone numbers are in here. If I'm out seeing someone and I want to jot her a note and say, would you call so-and-so and ask them about this issue? I can write that in here, and then when she synchronizes it, it gives her the message. I don't have to remember it. So Grant got a Palm Pilot. We're making progress. We're not quite there. Because last weekend we were going to go to a political satire in Oklahoma City called the Gridiron, where they make fun of people like me. And so I bought tickets, and I said, Grant, got tickets for the Gridiron. Great. So that day we call him up. Grant, got your tickets for Gridiron. Starts at 8 o'clock tonight. Oh, well, I'm going to Guthrie and taking Jen up to a bed and breakfast and got all these reservations. And, you know, it said Gridiron in my Palm Pilot, and I didn't know what that was. The point is this. We have a tendency, and I had this tendency in business early on. We have a tendency to want to hire people who are like us. Boy, that guy's a stickler for detail. You know, that guy's hardworking. We want to hire people who are like us. And so we wind up with a one-dimensional company. We need to hire people. If you're a stickler for detail, hire someone who's goofy. Hire someone who's a generalist. Hire someone who's very artistic. What is your wife like? I'll bet you she's different than you. I sure hope so. They tell us, that our kids took some tests, and they say that, and this is rather simplified, but they say that everyone in the way that you process information, the way that you think, you are either, let's see, you either think abstractly or concretely. Okay? If I were going to design a swimming pool, it would be some kind of a square shape, rectangular, square, whatever. That's how I think. I'm concrete. And you either process information sequentially, like boom, 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 or randomly, like boom, 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 boom. Okay. I am concrete, sequential. Guess what Grant is? He's abstract, random. Now, and don't get me wrong. I mean, Grant is a wonderful kid. He is very talented. But he's different than I am because my wife is different. You know, he's going to process information. You know what would be the worst thing in the world I could do to my son? The worst thing in the world, the unkindest thing in the world I could do to my son would be to have him come into business with me and try to make him like me. He's just not wired up that way. The best thing I can do is turn him loose. And I'll tell you what, he'll probably pass me on the track. Now, I can give him some advantages. I can open some doors for him. I can put some capital behind him. But I don't need for him to be like me. I need for him to be like God wants him to be and like God's made him to be. Because God made him the way he is. So we need to build on our strengths, and we need to maximize the impact of our strengths, but we need to staff to our weaknesses. If you're a generalist, God bless you. You're going to be able to accomplish a lot, but you need some people right beside you and right under you who are sticklers for detail. I have a friend who is probably the best salesman. If you just want a good hard-nosed salesman who can go out and sell anything, that's this guy. But he's smart enough to have people in his organization, some of whom he'll even listen to at times, who are sticklers for detail. Because if you put if you let the sales force run the company, you're in trouble. You know, if the guy driving the show is a salesman, and then everyone under him is a salesman, you got trouble. You know, we need accountants. Accountants. I don't want to be one, but we need them. Okay? We need engineers. We need lawyers. Not much, but we need them. And so staff to your weaknesses. Realize what you're strong in, realize what you're weak in, and surround yourself with people who compliment you, not people who are exactly like you. Pace yourself. Moses' father-in-law said, "This is not good. You are going to wear yourself out and all the people. You're going to wear all the people." Can you imagine? Let's just call the people in Moses' situation. Let's call them customers for a moment. You think they were very satisfied with the system Moses had going? "Honey, I got to leave early. I got to go get in line for Moses. Maybe I'll be up to see him in 3 days, you know." No. The job was not getting done. I mean, they had to stand around all day long and all into the evening and still didn't get it taken care of because it picked up again the next morning. And so his father-in-law says, pace yourself. Now, I don't care how dedicated you are, how much of a hard worker you are. You need rest. You know, even God rested after 6 days, didn't he? And, you know, I'll tell you what. My friend Paul is sitting over here. He's been on church staff for 30 years. And, Paul, you've seen men in the ministry who work 7 days a week. Because, you know, our off day is their work day. You know. And there are men in the ministry who work 7 days a week. There are men in the ministry who never take time off. But I'll tell you what, you're going to burn out if you do that. Now, guys, if you're involved in a discipleship ministry, your schedule can get pretty crazy. God did not intend for you to disciple the whole world. You know, even Jesus only tackled 12. And that was his vocation. So, pace yourself. In everything you do, pace yourself. If it's recreation, pace yourself. If it's work, pace yourself. If it's speaking engagements, pace yourself. If it's ministry, pace yourself. Otherwise, you're going to wear yourself out. Make time for rest, recreation, and relationships. I'll talk some more about that later. Number 7 is learn to say no. I'm sure Moses had people coming up to him and said, "Oh, Moses, you've been on the mountain with God. Surely you're the wisest man in the world. I want to see you." But they probably had a little piddling problem because his father-in-law said, "You take the difficult ones." But, you know, they ran it through really kind of a grid to where the easy ones got done by the leader of 10 and then the little bit tougher ones got done by the leader of 50. And we have processes like that in our businesses and in our governments. We got a problem right now, an issue in the city, where one group wants to, the Ronald McDonald House wants to bring a guy in to paint a whale on a big wall 600 foot long down in our Bricktown area, which is kind of the entertainment area of town. And they want to paint a whale there. Well, we have two different, we have an arts commission, so if you're going to have any art in a public place, then it has to go through the arts commission. Well, they were getting ready to just start throwing paint on the wall, and I sent my assistant over there. I said, "You tell them they got to go through the process." So it's got to go to the arts commission. It also has to go to the Bricktown Urban Design Committee. And if you're going to do anything that people can see in Bricktown, it has to be approved by the Bricktown Urban Design Committee. Now, let me give you a clue. Those guys very well, and if I don't want it to happen, I don't think it's going to happen. But do I want to be the guy who says, "No whale in Bricktown"? No. I want the process to work. Believe me, I want the process to work. And so the news media comes to me, and they wanted to come in and do a TV interview with me yesterday. "Where are you on the Bricktown whale?" "The whaling wall." And I said, "I don't need to do the interview. I'm going to let the process work." And that's what Moses did. Don't you imagine someone came to him, "Moses, won't you settle my dispute with my neighbor?" He said, "Well, have you talked to your leader of 10 yet? No, I haven't. Well, I'll tell you what, you talk to the leader of 10, and then, you know, you got to go clear up through 50, 100, and 1,000 before you get to me. So go through the process. I'll see you if I need to. When I was on the school board, I'd have parents call me, and they would say, I've got a problem with my kid's teacher. And so there's two ways I can respond to that. One is to say, oh, tell me about the problem. Or the other is to say, have you talked to the teacher, which, by the way, is a scriptural pattern, Matthew 18. Have you talked to the teacher? Invariably, no, I haven't. Well, if you would go talk to the teacher, probably you can get it worked out with the teacher. But if not, then go to the principal. And then you'll need to go right up principal, the principal supervisor, superintendent. And if it doesn't get resolved, then it'll come to the school board. Never got another call. This point is on learn to say no. I don't know how I got there off of that point. But Moses had to learn to say no to people when they wanted him to get involved. And I have to learn to say no, and you need to learn to say no. People come to you. My pastor, last weekend, I'm in a very small startup church. Last weekend, a couple of people came to me, different people, and they said, got a problem. So the next day I go to the pastor and I said, you know, you've got problems with several families in the church. No. Yeah. Well, what's the problem with so-and-so? I don't know. I haven't talked to them. I'm just, you know, I'm not going to go around talking to everybody and saying, please tell me what your problem is with the pastor. But I went to the pastor and said, you better go talk to him. Next day he goes and talks to all the people. He calls me that evening and said, I just had the greatest day. And you know what? The relationships got resolved and he learned some problems that he didn't know about. But sometimes people try to draw us into things, and we need to learn to say, have you talked to him yet? And say no to getting involved in that if it's not the right time for you to be involved. Number 8 is don't sweat the small stuff. Now, I'm not saying don't pay attention to details that you need to pay attention to. I'm not saying don't look at the budget. Probably the appropriate thing to do if you're in, you know, leadership position on the church board, you know, see they're living within the budget. Whether they spend it on stamps or stationery, I'm not sure is a big problem. When I say don't sweat the small stuff, I mean don't even worry about things that are not that big a deal. Remember, you need to know what your priorities are. And if someone tries to get you involved in something that's way off your priorities and really not that big a deal, don't get involved in it. Don't even worry about it. Just let it take its own course. Some other rules that I live by beyond Jethro. Know the difference between the important and the urgent. Plan ahead in making time for the important people in your life and the important things in your life. Where I live, and probably where you live, your life can get totally absorbed by the urgent. You know, the telephone person who's calling, the person at work that needs to see you about something, and they're urgent. They want to see you now. They want to have lunch with you this week. I had a guy call me say the other day, he said, hey, I'd like to get lunch with you. I said, he goes, but I know you have a bad schedule. I said, oh, it's not bad. I got it out and looked at it, and it was March 6th before I could have lunch with him. So we did something different. But in my life, they will totally fill up my schedule if I don't set aside time for the things I want to do. So I set aside Friday and Saturday, or Saturday and Sunday for family, for weekend. I set aside Friday for work. I set aside at the beginning of the year the weeks I want to take vacation. Now, you're going to think this is really bad, but this is true. I mean, I just told this to Paul, and he thought I was really bad, too. But my wife came to me, and she would come to me, and she goes, oh, can you have lunch today? Well, it's rare I can have lunch today. I mean, I can have lunch 3 weeks from now, but I can't have lunch today because someone else called and they booked a lunch. And so my wife called my secretary, and she told her to book my wife for a lunch once a quarter. Now, you think that's bad, that we have lunch once a quarter. I want to have lunch with my son, and so I have every Friday lunch scheduled for my son. And most of the time we have it. You know, sometimes he can't make it, but, you know, like today, we're not going to do it. But beg your pardon? No, he remembers those. Because I'm paying for lunch. He remembers. But you have to ask yourself, what are the important things in your life? Who are the important people? Now, let me get a little bit ludicrous here. I'm a big OU football fan. And the South shall rise again. Okay. And I assure you one thing that does not happen. It's happened about 5 times in 40 years. One thing that does not happen is for me to absentmindedly book something else and on an OU football Saturday. I've never absentmindedly done it. There have been about 5 times I've chosen to do something else. And so as soon as that schedule comes out, I get it on the calendar, because on those days I'm going to be in Norman going to a football game. We must establish, back to point number 2, live by established priorities. And so what I would encourage you to do is say, how much vacation we want to take this year? I mean, really? When do we want to do it? Put it on your calendar. Who are the people I need to keep touch with in life? We made a list. We call it the Big List. It's about 100 people. And this is in the political side. But there are just certain people you need to keep touch with if you're mayor of Oklahoma City. You know, I need to go see the newspaper publisher about once a quarter. I need to go see the guy that's on the radio talk show about once a quarter. Other folks, if I just touch base with them once a year, that's great. And so we have the big list, and then we put it on the calendar, and so every month my secretary knows who to schedule. And I get around and see those people. Because if I don't, I won't see them, because they're busy and I'm busy. Your situation may not be that complicated, but who do you need to keep touch with? Who are the people you'd like to keep touch with? Just longtime friends. Because if you don't schedule it, you won't see them. So you have to realize the difference between the important and the urgent, and you have to plan for the important, or the urgent will knock the important out. Next is live with a margin. It always takes 5 minutes longer than you think it will. I'm talking about if you're going somewhere, you have an appointment, and so you get ready to leave the office, and what happens when you're leaving the office? The phone rings. They say, hey, here's a message. Can you sign this check? You run into someone as you're walking out, and it'd be rude to just walk by them and not say hello. Plus, in your mind, you don't take the time, you don't count the time it takes to get from your desk to the car. You think, oh, it's a 15-minute drive. Well, that's true once you're out of the parking lot, but, you know, we just don't calculate it. So it always takes 5 minutes longer. Now, if you don't realize it takes 5 minutes longer, then guess what you're doing for the 15 minutes it takes to get there? You're speeding, and you're under stress, and the other folks are sitting there waiting, so you're being rude, and you're just under stress. In fact, you live your whole day that way. And so just realize, as you plan what you're doing, whether it's day or evening or whatever, things always take longer. I'm a pilot, and somehow, in going to the airport, getting the plane out of the hangar, pre-flighting the plane, taxiing out and taking off, you always lose a half an hour somewhere. It just takes a half an hour longer than you think it's going to take to do an airplane trip. And so I just calculate that in. Another good place to live with a margin, if you're a pilot, is in gasoline. You think, oh, this plane burns 15 gallons an hour, 60 gallons, I can go 4 hours. Well, that's true if you don't have to climb out, use the extra fuel to climb up to altitude. And that's true if you don't have to taxi the airplane. It just always takes more fuel than you think it will. And so you got to live with a margin. Number 11 is to schedule time daily for paperwork, mail, and phone calls. That's another thing we just don't schedule. Now, believe it or not, we put that on my schedule for an hour a day in the afternoon. Because what was happening was we just never got to it. I mean, you're scheduled all day long, and here's what happens. People come into your office, and you meet with them, and it doesn't take that long to spend 30 minutes talking to folks. And guess what they do when they're leaving? they say, oh, we brought you some things, and they give you books and stuff like that tall, like you're going to read them. You know, and I'm very nice, I accept them, and then I put them where they need to go. But you never get around to returning phone calls and handling the mail and doing paperwork if you don't schedule it. And if you have a real busy schedule, I would encourage you to block out a time every day, an hour or so, to just do that stuff. Now, maybe you're in business and you're running around all day and you say, well, I handle that in the evenings. But the problem is, if you kind of handle it in the evenings or on Saturday or whenever, what you're really doing is encroaching on other time, family time or whatever. And what I would encourage you to do is, if your work day is supposed to be over at 5 o'clock, then think of it as being over at 4 o'clock and use that last hour to clean stuff up. Return phone calls, handle mail, whatever. And if you're out running around town all day, be realistic about it, because for years, I would start my day at 8:30 in the morning and I would end my day at about 8 o'clock at night in business. And I can still, because what we did is we worked a normal day, and then after everyone left at 4:30 or 5, then we started doing our stuff. And that took place from about 5 o'clock to about 7 or 8. And I can still remember, this was a long time ago now, my wife negotiating with me to be home by 6:30 for dinner. That was a major victory for my wife, because I was at work being a workaholic. So schedule time daily for paperwork, mail, and phone calls. This may not apply to you, but if you do anything in meetings with groups, have a written agenda for staff meetings or group meetings. What I do with my, I do it with my staff at City Hall, and I do it with my staff at my business. The fellow who runs my business, it happened yesterday when I was in there. We sit down and he has a list. He has a list of the issue, the recommended action, the time frame involved, and then I can respond to it. And so it's just like we tick them off, just boom, 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 boom. Because if you don't, you're going to sit there and shoot the breeze and never get to the key issues, and you don't know where you're going. And so if you have, a written agenda or a written list of items to be discussed and dealt with, it does several things for you. One, it gives you a track to run on. Secondly, it's a written record of the meeting and what was discussed and what you told them to do. I write down, if I say, okay, accept that offer on the land, then I write down, okay, the offer's this much, and told him to accept her, told him to counter at this price, and I throw that in a drawer, and he can't come back and say, well, you never told me that, because I've got it written down. And he knows what he's doing, I know what he's doing. So your meeting will be much more productive if it's any kind of group, if it's a meeting where you're handling business, if you have a written agenda or a written list of issues that you're dealing with. Now, if it's just that we're visiting, and I mean, a lot of my calls at City Hall are, they're stopping by to tell me about their deal. Well, that wouldn't be something where there's a written agenda. But particularly in staff or small committee or whatever. A couple of years ago, my wife got me involved in the PTA. Great thrill. I had been on the school board, and it was before I ran for mayor, and the PTA at my child's elementary school came and said, would you be PTA president? I said, no. And they finally went and got my wife, and they got my wife to agree that I would be PTA president. Yeah, delegate. And so I did delegate. I said, look, I didn't agree to that. And she goes, look, if you'll run the meetings, I'll do the work. I said, okay. And so we would go into PTA meeting, and I would have a written agenda of all the items and possible alternatives, and that's the way we did it. And so there's nothing worse to try to run than a PTA meeting, because most of them are not men. Thirteen, redeem small blocks of time. You may have 5 minutes free time, 10 minutes free time. Maybe it's your commuting time. And I know they say car phones aren't safe, but, maybe I'll die that way. I don't know. But, if I'm getting in the car and driving somewhere, I'm probably going to be on the car phone returning phone calls. And scripture memory. The wonderful thing about this move we're going to make as a family, it makes my commute about 25 minutes instead of 10 or 12 minutes. But I don't view that as negative, because I can use that for quiet time. I don't mean quiet time devotional. I just mean quiet, restful time. Or I can also, the best times in my life I've ever had for scripture memory were when I regularly drove the car some distance. Like in college, 3 days a week I was back and forth to Oklahoma City, and that was about a 35-minute drive, and so, boom, I could just really keep up with it. The early days in business, when I was calling on stores out, driving around the state, real easy to keep up with it when you're regularly in the car for, a substantial amount of time. So I don't view the extra 10 or 15 minutes going out there as negative. I view it as perhaps even positive. It'll be some time when I can do the things I want to do while driving the car. So redeem those small blocks of time. Don't just cool your heels. Use them to handle mail or return phone calls or scripture memory or whatever. Number 14 is handle paper once. I read a book years ago on Stephanie Winston. I forget what she called it. But she had four things that you do with mail. You trash it, you refer it, you act on it, or you file it. And what you don't want to do is pick up a piece of paper and look at it, think about it, and then think, well, I'll get to that later. And so, you're shuffling paper around. And I don't know about you, but that is my tendency, is to shuffle it around, wind up with briefcases full of papers that I don't even know where they are, and then they get weeks old. And, I can't tell you I have total victory on this, but I can tell you I work on it. And I do better at some times than others. The goal on handling paperwork should not be to ignore it for so long that when you finally look at it, it's out of date and you get to throw it away. That should not be the goal. But unfortunately, you may not have anyone to refer it to, and if that's your position, I feel for you. You may have to handle everything. But trash it, just a lot of stuff. You never want to read. It's just trash. Or something, you look at it and it's advising you of something, you read it, and then you don't need to keep it, so read it and trash it. Or you refer it. If you're going to refer it to somebody and they're going to handle it, this is back to Moses' deal. If someone came to Moses and it was a leader of 10 type problem, why should he even read it? As soon as he knows it's a leader of 10 type problem, what he ought to do is refer it to Bill. He'll probably never see it again. And so when I get projects, I refer it to the city manager, I refer it to my assistant, I refer it to my secretary, or I have a separate 10-type problem. Why should he even read it? As soon as he knows it's a leader of 10-type problem, what he ought to do is refer it to Bill. He'll probably never see it again. And so when I get projects, I refer it to the city manager, I refer it to my assistant, I refer it to my secretary, or I have a separate stack for me and a separate stack for my filing. And so when I go back to City Hall the next day, this is if I get a bunch of stuff on a weekend, go back to City Hall the next day, then I can give them all their stacks and I only have this much left that I've got to handle. So handle paper once. Try not to even, when you pick it up, try to deal with it then instead of setting it down again without it being handled. Okay, questions or comments? Yes, sir. When I ran for mayor, I had a pager. I called it my electronic leash. And the day I won, I gave it back to him. My phone number, my home phone, is in the phone book. You won't believe it, but I get about one call a month at home on city business. I mean, that's about it. I think people are afraid to call the mayor. They'll call the city councilman. They'll call someone else. They won't call the mayor. But my phone number is listed. Of course, my cell phone is not listed, and I don't give that number out that much because I don't want them calling me and running up my bill. So I don't have a pager. I do not have email. And the reason I don't have email, if they don't care enough to call me on the phone or write me a letter or come see me, then they don't care very much, and I'm not going to waste my time on them. But I do believe I'm very accessible. I mean, if if any citizen calls City Hall, and it, I mean they call a bunch every day, if they call City Hall, if they have a problem that can be referred to one of our, you know, if their problem is my trash didn't get picked up, then I really don't need to meet with them on that. But we do want to get their problem handled. And so we will get them in contact with someone that can help them to where they, their problem gets taken care of. But there are many times when someone will call City Hall and they'll say, I want to talk to the mayor about such and such. And I call them back and they can't believe it's me. Oh, I didn't think you'd really call me back. I said, no, I returned my phone calls. And I really do. I return my phone calls promptly. So I think I'm quite accessible, but quite frankly, they're going to have to make some... What I don't want is some guy that's sitting at home at 10:30 at night on email, and he's got a wild hair, and so he's going to zip something off to me, and I'm supposed to respond to it. If he doesn't care any more than that, then I don't care either. Okay? Right here.
Kurt, I appreciate access a lot. I think we're getting off the mayor's phone.
I don't think so. The question is the phone a hindrance to good time management? Their chance of calling and getting me directly is pretty slim because most days I'm scheduled all day long. Well, at home, they just don't... I don't get very many calls. I don't know why, but and if they do call me, I'll handle it just like, you know, I'm gonna trash it, refer it, act on it, or file it. But you know, generally they have a problem with that someone else can help them with, and so then what I'll do is I'll make a little note in my Palm Pilot and say, would you call so and so, and they have a problem with it, and you know, then I'm done with it. But I don't think it's a tyranny of the urgent to be available at home. I really don't. I think that I think if you're an elected official, that comes with the territory. John? Gee whiz, I wish I could remember. There's a girl named Stephanie Winston that's written several books on time management, and I just read one of those. But really... most of what I've learned just through the school of hard knocks. But I think the biggest problem that we have on time management, a real good book on time management is Proverbs. Realizing that God has created us, God's allotted the time to us, every day is valuable. And so get the perspective that we have enough time to do what God wants us to do. And saying, I don't have enough time is a cop-out and is poor theology. But there are plenty of books on the market, but I haven't read all of them, so I can't recommend them. Maybe, does anyone else have a good book on time management?
There's the Nance Press book by Richard Swinson called Margins.
Okay. Richard Swinson, Margins, others? Okay. Another hand back here, I think. Yeah.
How do you find faithful people?
How do you find faithful people to delegate things to, and how do you know if they're not being faithful? This is going to sound bad, but I don't trust people until they earn trust. And I will be real quick to fire a person. I think we all know when a person doesn't fit the job. And it doesn't mean they're a bad person. It just means it's not a good fit. Let me tell you a little story. I hired a girl. Trying to depend on bad people is like trying to walk on a broken leg. And we all know the feeling when we've been there. I hired a girl, and we were myself and two girls in the office, and this was kind of the lead girl. And a lot of people think I'm just, you know, Attila the Hun on dealing with people, but, you know, I really struggled with this one. And finally, I go home, and my son, who was about 10 at the time, Blair, he goes, Dad, because I was complaining to my wife and stuff at dinner, taking her through the events of the day, and he goes, Dad, why don't you just fire her? And so I did. You know when people aren't a fit. And like I say, it does not necessarily mean they're bad people. We tried hiring my brother-in-law at one time when we were in the wholesale business, and we were going to teach him the business and make him be like us. Remember what I said about make him like us? And our wholesale business was a nuts and bolts kind of detail kind of business, at least the way we ran it. This guy is now a Christian counselor on a church staff. Do you think he was a fit? And after about 2 years, he was working hard, but you know, it just wasn't clicking. And so we hired a Christian industrial psychologist to come down, spend a day or two with him, check him out, see what he was good at, see what made him tick, see what kind of job would fit him. And the guy gave us a report back and said, if you searched the world over for the worst job for this man, it would be the one you have him in. And so I called my brother-in-law up and I said, you know, I'd like to eat breakfast with you. And we met and I told him that. And he got teary-eyed. He goes, I am so glad. He goes, I've had migraine headaches over this. Trying hard to do this job, and it's just not a fit. I mean, if we take a square peg and try to put him in a round hole and he doesn't succeed, is that his fault or our fault? That's our fault. And I said, look, this is our mistake, not yours. And so, I mean, I terminated my brother-in-law. I said, we moved you where you are. We'll move you anywhere you want to go. We did. And I said, we're going to give you this length of time to get readjusted. Before that length of time was up, he found another job, and he was ahead financially because, you know, we paid him this much regardless. And we have a great relationship today and have always. But we don't do a person a service to try to put them in a job that they're not well suited for. And it took me a long time to figure that out. So for a person to serve you well, they must be well suited. And what I would encourage you to do, it's very rare to hire a friend and have it work out. Now, Derry Myers, I hired, he was a friend, and he worked at our company for about 17, 18 years, and it was a tremendous deal. But he is the best salesman of that type of product I've ever seen. I mean, he was just tremendous at it. But I think that's the exception, not the rule. I think it is rare when you can hire a friend and have it work out. And that's very rare in that we're still good friends after all those years. But I sure wouldn't recommend it. There are exceptions to every rule. What I would do is I would define the job, and then I would search. You know, maybe that's a local search through an ad, or maybe it's a national search. But I would generate as many prospects as I could for that job, and then I would, depending on the process. When I hired an assistant at City Hall, I didn't want to get directly involved in it because there were people who wanted that job that I had run my campaign. They'd done various things. They were friends, and I wanted some protection. So I got three men that I trusted, had them interview. I had our personnel department go from like 75 applicants down to 15, gave them the 15. Those guys decided which one they wanted to interview. They interviewed them all, and they gave me the top three candidates ranked. I interviewed those three. I agreed with their ranking. I hired the number one guy. But you got to define the job and then match that candidate against the parameters of the job. And the more objective that process can be, the better. And the fellow that runs my business, I had about 75 candidates, got down to about five, tested those five, several tests that indicate what people are good at and what they're bad at, which I would highly recommend tests that target that particular job, the type of skills you would need in that job. And some of these were even personality type tests. In my company, you know, a small real estate development company, I don't want a guy who wants my job. I mean, if he wants to be a zillionaire right now, he's either going to be unhappy or a thief. So I want a guy that's the right amount of aggressive, the right amount of independent. It's a delicate balance. Now, I found that guy. He's been with me about 3 years, and he's happy. His pay is about doubled, and he owns a little chunk of the company, and he's doing great and having fun, and I trust him. And so good people are like a good wife. They're a gift from God. but you don't get them automatically. You've got to look hard. And what I would say is if they don't fit, you know it pretty quickly, and I would deal with it. You know it within about 2 weeks in your gut. Now, your head may not want to admit it, but your gut knows it. And then what I would do is when I hire a person, I say, tell you what, we're going to go 90 days, and at the end of 90 days, I'm going to sit down and tell you how you're doing. And if I don't believe the job's a fit for you, I'm going to tell you that. And I think they really appreciate that. And if it's a fit for them at 9 days, they probably want a raise, and they probably deserve it, and they want to hear that they're doing a good job. And I think they deserve that. The unkindest thing you can do as a boss is not tell them how they're doing. We've got about 10 minutes left. Yes, over here.
I was just wondering, if you talked about earlier days, working all the hours,
yeah,
and kind of coming around and coming to a different perspective on things, where you're blocking out time for other things that are important. Now, I've heard other people have a similar experience. What do you think of the young guys? Was that, working like a dog in the early days? Is that
good or bad?
Is that good or bad?
The question is working like a dog in the early days a good or bad? I'll tell you what. It really is different when you have enough money to where you don't need to worry about it. That can really affect your priorities. Gene War came up to me when I was back in those days, and he goes, I'm worried about you're working too hard. And I thought, well, Gene, if I had your money, I wouldn't have to worry about it either. The Bible says there is a time to plant and a time to sow. And it says it's good for a young man to bear the yoke in his youth. You would hope that when you're 45, you don't have to work under the same conditions that you did when you were 25. But if you don't work hard when you're 25, you're going to have to work hard when you're 45. And so what I would say to a young man is bear the yoke in your youth. You probably don't need 5 weeks off a year. I would encourage you to take two. Our philosophy was the first 2 years we were in business, we only took a week off in total. And that was my honeymoon. But we figured out that if business was good, we needed the break and we could afford it. And if it was bad, it wouldn't make any difference anyway. So we started taking 2 weeks, and then later on it was three, and then later on it was more. But I think there's a time to plow and plant and sow. And in a man's life, that's probably generally before he's 40 or 45. And if you do that and save and become proficient in your career, then generally you should be able to back off some and look more toward long-term priorities in the middle years of life, would be my answer. Stephen Covey's book, he mentioned Seven Habits of Highly Effective People.
Yeah.
Okay. Elaborate on Learn to Say No. Okay. Well, I'll just take a stab at it. I don't know what I was going to say, but what I would say is this. Number two was establish your priorities, live by established priorities. I know your life is not like mine, but let me give you the example from my life. We have this stack of requests each week. Would you come speak to us? Would you do this for us? Would you do that? I'm probably going to do that if it is something that fits with my priorities of where I want to take the city, or if it's a favor for a friend. If it doesn't fit those two things, I'm not going to do it. Let me give you an example. If Lance calls me and says, would you come? And here's what will happen. Lance calls my office, said, can Kurt come and speak to our church? My secretary will say, would you put it in writing to us and tell us when it is, how long you want to speak, and what you want it to be about? And if he's not going to even do that and fax us a letter, then we don't even waste our time with him. I never hear about it. But if he'll do that, then she brings it into that meeting. And so she'll say, okay, they want you to come to Bridgeway Church. It's a Saturday morning's men's breakfast. And they want you to speak for 30 minutes on something. My first question is going to be, because remember this is Saturday and that's a family day. My first question is going to be, is who's asking? If it's Lance, then I'll say, yeah, if it's a Saturday, I can do that. Yeah, I'll do that. And if it's not a Saturday, I can do it. I said, well, I can't do it then, but tell them I can do it these dates. But if it doesn't fit my priorities and it doesn't fit the time blocks that I've set aside, and it's a person I don't know, then I'm going to say no. And that whole conversation with her is going to take about 20 seconds. And then we're on to the next one. Now, sometimes my wife gets frustrated with me because I take something and she goes, why'd you take that? I go, honey, this is not rocket science, but we spend about 20 seconds on it. You know, you're going to wind up doing some things. The more you know, you wouldn't have done it. But learn to say no. As I would just say, if it doesn't fit your priorities or some purpose that you have, when I say who's asking, that's a purpose because it's a personal relationship. But if it doesn't fit those things, then just say no. Move on down the road. Well, I think it needs to be something that, let me tell you, I don't care if you're not in my position. I did this before I was mayor, and I highly recommend it. Have a time every year. For us, it's in the fall of the year, and we still do it. Have a time every year where you and your wife get apart. Now, maybe it's just overnight for a night, or maybe it's a week. Maybe it's a few days. Whatever it is, have a time every year where you get away with your wife, not the kids, and you say, how are we doing? Where do we want to go? What do we want to change? What do we want to add? What do we want to cut out? And so you are looking at your life, you're taking a mid-course check on things, and you're setting out what your long-range priorities are, adjusting those, and particularly your priorities for the next year. And we do that in September every year, and I'd highly recommend it. Not really. I really don't. I've done them. 1 year, 5 year, 10 year goals. I think when you get in 5 and 10 year, you're really talking about general direction in life. I have a hard time with more than 5 years out, other than just principles you live by. I think up to 5 year, you can make decisions. And for us buying this house we're buying, we call it a 5 year decision. 5 years from now, my daughter's out of high school, we'll go do something else probably. I think beyond 5 years, good night. Crawford's lived 108, but we may not. And so I think beyond 5 years, you're talking about general biblical principles you live by, but I have a hard time with going further out than that. 2.5 years ago, I never planned to be mayor, never planned to do it. And so God, you know, makes course adjustments for us. We have time for about two more questions. Well, gee, if you're going to worry about offending people, you don't want my job.
Well, then also, you know, once you do offend them,
you know, worrying about offending people, if you have established what your priorities are and those priorities are offensive to somebody, then so what? Let's just be offensive. But secondly, I'm not sure that most people will be offended. Let's put it down on a more practical level. If they're going to invite you to the local Young Life banquet, annual fundraising banquet, that's a good thing. I've been to them. I've sponsored tables at them. And so someone calls you up and says, would you come to the local Young Life banquet? Well, let's say you know it's a fundraising banquet and you've got your giving planned and you don't have any flexibility to give. Which would be more kind? To go and eat their $25 chicken or to say, you know, that really doesn't fit our priorities and I'd rather have someone else sit at that table. I think it's more kind to be honest with them up front. We get calls from people on giving all the time. And our answer is, there were times when I had so much money to give that I would give John Crawford's account a check at the end of the year, and a good one, and say, now, John, you pass this around to the guys where they need them, but don't tell them who gave it. Right, John? For several years. Well, those are not today. But those days are not now. And so now we only give to people that we know personally and who've had a ministry in our life or someone that we're close to. That's the people we give to. And so if someone calls and says, And I'm not knocking Campus Crusade because we give to Campus Crusade and people with Crusade. But someone will call and say, "Hi, I'm so-and-so with Crusade, and I'm getting ready to go out, and so-and-so gave me your name." I'll say, "Well, look, I don't want you wasting your time. We only give to people that have had a ministry in our life and that we know personally and have a ministry in our life or someone close to us. Tell them what your priorities are, and if it doesn't fit your priorities," that's not offensive to them. They appreciate the honesty. And then they say, "Well, great, can you give me three names of friends?" And I say, "No, I don't like people to do that to me, and I don't do that to people." You know. So I don't think it's offensive to establish your priorities and live by those. One more question.
It's not a question, but you mentioned about mail. I have an addresser with me that if you guys get bukus of bulk mail, third class, you can send your address to this address, and 2-3 weeks later, all that stuff.
And it works, huh?
It works,
yeah. Gee, will they quit sending you catalogs? Okay, our time's up. Thanks. I'll be up here if you have questions.